Hey there, Larry. How are you tonight?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm well. I am now I'm sunburned. Spent the day on the lake and it hurts.
Well, tell me about that lake. Where's that lake located? Is it one I might know?
Oh, I'm pretty sure you know of it. I mean, it's one of the big ones. It's Jackson Lake.
Oh, that would be in the big county of Butts,
It
which
is
is just
definitely
off
Butts
south.
County. Can you
Yes,
imagine?
but
I'm the sheriff of Butts County. Can you imagine that?
Butts County, yes, that'll be that's just one county over from Newton, where I was born.
Oh, wow. I'm not sure that that's a something that I would run around and put on my resume as being an attribute.
Well, but Newton County has far exceeded the growth of Butts County. Butts County has just kind of lingered and languished, and Newton County has really exploded and become a fairly progressive metro suburb of East Atlanta. So I'm okay with Newton County now. They've matured.
Okay. I don't think Butts County has.
Not yet. But the growth is eventually going to push in there because of the just running out of ways to expand that constant Atlanta area. They're just going to eventually it's going to pour in there also.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. It's still, God, that's a long drive. And once you hit all the traffic of the south side of Atlanta and Henry County, it all just turns to shit.
You can't say that on a family program.
I'm sorry. Close your kids' ears. There's a bad word.
It's itche for those who speak Latin.
And we will be talking about the heat here shortly, so stand by. Hey, please consider making us part of your podcast diet. And by that, I mean using like a podcast app to me just makes the most sense. It just shows up on your phone, it automatically downloads. You don't have to do anything, you don't have to wait for an email message to show up from any other sources. It just makes the most sense. So get a podcast app, subscribe to it, search for Registry Matters. You can find us on all of the podcast apps. And also, if you don't want to do that, feel free to go write a review at iTunes or someplace like that. And that would just be great. Also, this show is supported by our patrons, and you guys and gals are great. You're amazing. We love you. And if you would like your own exclusive Registry Matters Blue Balls, please consider becoming a patron and show your support for the show. This week, we would like to thank our newest patrons, Larry, he's a crackpot, Patty, and Hank, many thanks, and I'll send out your blue balls next week.
I can't wait for my blue balls.
You already have one. I gave you one at the conference.
Yeah, I think I gave that to someone else. It has vanished.
Shame. Wow. All right. Well, I guess I'll send one to you.
You can hold off. I'll be there in less than 2 months, and you can give me blue balls then.
All right then. Wow. And you talk about me in a family show. Well, anyway, thank you very much to the new patrons. And as I said, I'll send out a blue ball to you next week. Thank you so much. This first article is Governor Cuomo in New York stands up for sex offenders. He's essentially giving people, well, I mean, I'm not sure the situation of New York, but he's giving people convicted of crimes, he's giving them at least a they're calling it a partial pardon or conditional pardon, that they can now vote again. And that includes people who have been convicted of various sexual offenses, including the more severe looking ones. And a lot of, I guess, more conservative types are yelling back saying, "Oh my God, you can't let these people vote. They're too dangerous."
It doesn't surprise me. It's very similar to what happened in the state of Virginia when former Governor McAuliffe decided that he was going to unilaterally, after efforts in the legislature fizzled, he was going to use his executive clemency powers to blanketly restore voting to people who had paid their debt to society. And that's what Governor Cuomo's doing in New York. But this type of thing scares conservatives for some reason. They believe that if people who have been in trouble, they're magically going to be liberal. Now, that's not true. But in New York State Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan, a Republican, lambasted the policy. This policy, quote, "This policy rewards the worst of the worst sexual predators and lowlifes in our society and undermines the integrity of our voting system in every way, shape, and form," Flanagan said, according to New York Daily News. "Might be worth our while to reach out to Mr. Flanagan and say, well, the overwhelming experience we have advocating for people who have been convicted of sexual offenses, that they're much more likely to vote for you." than for a liberal. But apparently, according to the article that we're reading, the first group of conditional pardons affect 24,000 people. And apparently there's more to come. And 71% of them are either African-American or Hispanic, which would scare conservatives because they think that those people are going to be lockstep Democrats. And they're not. A lot of Hispanics are very conservative.
Yeah, they definitely have like a conservative leaning from a religious point of view, but they typically vote Democrat.
And African Americans are more likely to vote Democratic, but there again, some of these analyses are breaking down. But this type of thing scares conservatives because the more people participate, the more they fear that they would not continue to be able to prevail in elections if we had more participation. But that's what the article's about. And we give kudos to Governor Cuomo for doing his best, as we gave kudos to former Governor McAuliffe in Virginia.
Well, let me ask you this though: Do you think there's a certain amount of, I'm going to use the word cynical in this, is there an evil ulterior motive behind restricting voting rights of certain kinds of people?
I'd have to do some research to know how that the process developed. But I can tell you, since the efforts have been underway to tear down these barriers, that there's a lot of pushback from on it, because there's a fear that these people are going to be in the handout population of wanting something for nothing, and they're going to sway the balance of power. But how the origin and what the theory was, I don't think I'm prepared with enough information to say how, if it was some kind of evil, sinister thing to take away people's voting after they've been convicted.
I'm wondering then, if conservatives are typically scared of giving voting rights back, I'm wondering that, and we could probably easily, even just while we're recording, do a quick tally. Conservative states, do they typically allow people to vote versus left-leaning states? Do they typically allow ex-felons to vote? Is there a kind of stereotypical breakdown? Wondering, is this a way to sort of gerrymander?
Well, it is. The harshest restrictions typically are in the more conservative states, but not universally. I mean, Florida is a harsh state in terms of voting. That's where there's actually litigation now pending about the process of trying to restore voting rights. I just intuitively, I know from my limited research that it's different. Oh, you got states up in the Northeast where they don't even take away the right while the person is serving time.
Right.
That would be some liberal states like Vermont and in Maine, New Hampshire, in that area where they're not even disenfranchised.
Do you think it's even is it a reasonable argument to say, look, you have proven yourself unworthy to make proper decisions. We don't want, quote unquote, your kind to vote.
I'd be hard pressed to go along with that, because there's a lot of people who've made unwise decisions in their life. Criminal acts are just but one of many unwise decisions that people make. And we don't disenfranchise people because they're not the best decision makers. We don't have a certain citizenship test that you're required to demonstrate proficiency in knowledge and information before they're allowed to vote. So I'm not ready to sign on to that, but currently we have people who are not sufficiently informed voting, no doubt about it.
Yeah, no doubt. The other question that I would have, we have the Constitution that sets up a whole framework, and then we have the Bill of Rights. Your voting rights are not a Bill of Rights thing. They are constitutional. How does a state take away your right to vote that is enshrined in the Constitution itself?
Well, it's like the Second Amendment that's enshrined but people do under certain, it's not absolute. And I suppose there again, without studying intensely, I suppose that through the years, it's been one of those accepted infringements after people have committed felonies and serious crimes, as far as whether they should have the right to fully participate. The movement has been the other direction. A lot of states have torn those barriers down, particularly after people have done their time. And you know, it surprises me that New York is even having this discussion. I would have thought that they would have moved forward a long time ago.
Yeah, they're one of the most left of the left, right?
Well, not at the moment. They're actually, the legislature in New York is very conservative, but they have a more liberal executive, but a conservative-dominated legislature. But I would have thought that they would have made progress a long time ago.
There's a quote in the article. It says, this policy rewards the worst of the worst sexual predators and lowlifes in our society and undermines the integrity of our voting system in every way, shape, and form, Flanagan said, according to the Daily News. Conditional pardons were supported by many Democrats, reformers, and Cuomo supporters, Politico reported in April.
Well, there again, it's just those liberals wanting to destroy the country, it sounds like to me. Doesn't it to you?
Absolutely. I mean, why would you want people that have been affected by a particular system of our government to not have a say in that system?
That's right. They make one mistake, you're out.
And that's why I don't know if gerrymandering is the right term for that, but that's sort of how it feels. I mean, you've taken a segment of people and you've said, oh, hey, well, you don't get this privilege anymore because you've been affected by it. People on the other side, the people that have never been affected by the registry or the criminal justice system, they are like, well, shit, just throw away the key, man. Lock them up, throw away the key, feed them bread and water. What do they need workout and TV for?
Well, there is a certain amount of gerrymandering. As I said earlier, if 71% of the people had been restored or a minority, that would tell you that those people had been disenfranchised, which would have diminished the true representation of that population.
Well, let's move on to something way more inspiring and optimistic sounding. This is from the Marshall Project, where it says, cooking them to death, the lethal toll of hot prisons. And so, hey, tell me about the temperature out there in the Southwest. Particularly, I think, last week, not this past week.
Well, it's to the west of us, it's a lot worse than we're experiencing here. If you go from New Mexico over to Arizona and California, they're having some tremendous heat. In Phoenix, Death Valley, literally is Death Valley. They've had to shut down the tourists in the Death Valley because too much danger of people dying from the
heat. It's up in the teens.
It's up in the 112, 115 range in Phoenix regularly, and it's that's where former Sheriff Arpaio tried to cook them to death there, and it's a thing that we talked about before, and I keep putting these articles in here because I do it for one reason, and that's to remind people of who we are as a people. When we send a person to prison, we basically render that individual helpless.
Mm-hmm.
They can't provide for their medical care. They can't provide for their food. They have very little way to provide for their personal safety. And they certainly can't provide for an environment that allows them. We have people all ages. They have all mental and physical health ailments incarcerated. And the prison system has a responsibility to keep these people safe from all threats, because they're not able to do that for themselves. And their punishment is loss of their liberty, not to be put into an oven and cooked to death, or to have serious health ailments befall them because of the environment that they're putting them in. And it's just sad and tragic that we've got this mentality, particularly in the southern states. I'm going to pick on you again, because you need to start calling your lawmakers if you live in the South and say, I repudiate these policies of cooking prisoners to death. This is not who we are as Americans. And it's really bad in Texas. It's really bad in the southern states, where they think it's a part of the experience of prison is to see how much misery you can inflict.
There's a block in the article that says the human body is built to cool itself down by sweating and dilating blood vessels, but those self-cooling mechanisms can break down. When the humidity is really high, the sweat can't evaporate. But even out west, where it's like the humidity is 10 or 20, 30%, but the people are probably kind of like, you're in an enclosed space. There's not ventilation. It's not like they open up the entire wall for air to freely flow through. There's just tiny little slats for windows because you don't want these people escaping. And or Joe Arpaio, and you're just in a tent outside, and he actually then turns up the heat on the water for you, so you can't even cool off with some sort of shower. You might have limited access to water, especially ice water. Somehow, they're setting you up to just have a failure after failure after failure, just because the whole system isn't designed to treat you with some basic level of dignity. It's a really crappy system.
It really is. Texas prisons are notoriously bad. The courts are constantly intervening in Texas. And then a state senator in this article, John Whitmire, who chairs the Senate Criminal Justice Committee, said back in 2011 about air conditioning. But number one, we just don't want to.
Now, clearly.
He's a Democrat. So I'm doing something that people seldom hear me say. He's not chair today because the Democrats are not in the majority. But you should repudiate that. You should call them and say, you don't represent our values. We're not sitting punishing people by cooking them to death and inflicting harm on their health. We're punishing them by taking away their liberty.
But what about the flip side of that of saying, well, I mean, should you be sitting there in a lazy boy and, you know, having a Mai Tai while you're in prison?
Well, I think that's an extreme reaction to compare that with a basic human. I mean, Joe R. Pyle took great satisfaction in air conditioning the dog kennels that the sheriff's department provided manpower to maintain. And he said that he believed there was nothing wrong with treating the dogs better than people. It took the voters 3 decades to reject that from our pile.
I don't have the word in my vocabulary to describe that as what your outlook on society is. I mean, that's just such a you just think that there are certainly classes of people in that. I mean, there's a caste system that you would. So here's the royalty, here are the workers, and here are just the people that you just want to throw in a poop pile and let them wallow around in a poop pile.
Well, a federal judge ordered the Louisiana state pen to lower the temperature from 109 to 88. can you imagine that? And that's the heat index to lower it from 109 to 88. That's quite astonishing. Most of us wouldn't do very well even at 88.
No, I don't keep my apartment that hot, not by any stretch. How do you then straddle the fence? I mean, obviously the South is hotter than the North. The North is probably even less prepared for this, where you have a freak heat wave, you know, where they're experiencing up in New England, they're experiencing weather in the 90s. They possibly don't even have air-conditioned prisons on purpose. And now they end up in a situation where the temperatures are extreme and they're literally not prepared for it. The South, they're purposely not planning for it.
Well, in cases like that, you would take ameliorating factors, take precautions, and you can do things. Fans are fairly effective at moving air if
Certainly.
It doesn't get too hot, and then you can bring ice on the cell blocks. You can provide more access to showers for cool down. You can do things to ameliorate the effect of the heat. You have to be inclined to want to do that.
Yeah,
and our prison administrators, by and large, are not inclined to want to do that because they're not mollycoddling criminals.
The other key piece here that comes to mind, and I reference this a lot, especially in relation to the registry of the harsh treatment post, is that if you wanted to give the people a death sentence, and I know this is extreme and you're going to push back, but if you wanted to give people a death sentence, then you should have given them a death sentence. Do not send them into a situation where they can't help themselves and ultimately die from the environment. And that's just, like I said, if you wanted them to die, you should have just killed them.
Well, I'm not going to push back much. We can't sentence people. All the people who go to prison, very few would be eligible for a death penalty.
Right.
Their crimes were not at the magnitude for even states that have the death penalty to be considered for the death penalty. We've got these people. But the people that die, which there are dozens of them that die across the country, particularly when we have prolonged heat, there's the people not only die, but they have serious adverse reactions. And this would be, we've got a retired doctor in New Mexico we might invite, could be far more eloquent than I am explaining this, but excessive heat can have enormous ramifications on people's health.
Yeah, you can suffer brain damage from it, for sure.
And like I said, I can't even begin to, but I know that it's not good.
No. And it wouldn't be fun either. I mean, that's a very harsh way to go of having your brain overheat to the point that it actually incurs brain damage in the process. And that's why, you know, there are in certain cities, there are like cooling centers for people that are of lower socioeconomic status where they can get out of their house that doesn't have air conditioning, go to some sort of community center and cool off. Or go to a public pool or something like that. There are cities that have those programs in place. But again, we're back to these people that are, for all practical purposes, they're indigent based on
they're in a cage.
Yeah. Or a group cage. I mean, yeah, they're locked in and now they can't get out. I mean, they're designed to not let you out for security reasons. And now these people are dying from just the environment itself and they certainly can't get out. It's really just, well, and I mean, I told you earlier in the pre-show that where I was, the It was designed to have air conditioning, and it worked well until it didn't. But the building wasn't designed to move air in and out, if that was the case. And they had bolted the windows shut because people abuse that privilege, and trying to move contraband in and out through the window. So they bolted them shut. Well, now the air conditioner goes out. What do you think happens in Georgia in the summertime? It gets pretty frickin' warm. And so somebody tells their mom or whatever at visitation, maybe on the phone, and says, "Hey, look, we're kind of roasting in here." Mom calls the warden. Next thing we know, we get a visit from the warden the next day, and he's chewing the guy out for ratting him out for us roasting. It's like, that's twisted logic.
It is indeed.
That's victim blaming if there ever was an example of it. But anyway, so that's the bad news. Let's move on to some gooder news.
Well, I'm going to keep bringing up this heat thing when I see it, because I continue to believe it reflects who we are.
I agree.
And our uncaringness. So I'm going to pop these in here when I see them, because until we change our public perception of how we want to treat people who we put in cages, it's not going to change until the people demand it.
I totally agree. There was a post on Twitter earlier, and Mary Davy DeVoy, she wrote back, like, the way she was responding to it was, the way that we're going to change this is tell our politicians that we don't want you to do this. This is party irrelated. If you have a conservative person and you want them to support not cooking them, tell them. If it's a liberal and you don't want them to support cooking, tell them. And they can then move that forward if they want to, and they get enough support behind it.
Absolutely.
Right?
And if they're getting those communications from the constituents, they will get on the floor and they will say that. I have received calls, emails from my constituents saying they deplore this, and they will make those speeches on the floor and in committee. If they're hearing those kind of concerns, that gives them the cover they need to do what we call, quote, the right thing.
And this will, so I think this was a question that we had from a Patreon person, Mike in Florida, and I don't know that we ever addressed it, but this is a decent segue to take a little detour off of that. He asked the question of, what can someone do that isn't able to vote? And this would be one of those things. No one's going to stop you from calling not just your legislator, but one in another district, right?
Absolutely. I was going to answer that, and I'm glad you brought that up again, because you're not spewing out any type of radioactivity. They don't know in public settings where they're taking feedback from their constituents, whether you're a voter or not. You don't have that. They don't have that ability to determine that about you. All they know is that you showed up for an event and you raised your hand and you wished to say something, which means you can speak eloquently and tell them how you feel about this. I live in your district, or I don't live in your district. And you can tell them. That's one way you can have impact. You can show up in your capital if you're close enough to your capital. Except from Florida, I don't know how close he is to Tallahassee, but he can show up if he's anywhere near Tallahassee and tell them when they're having hearings on particular things that the Florida Action Committee might be following, for example. They don't know whether he's a voter or not.
They don't know if he's a registrant or not.
They don't know that either. So absolutely, there are things you can do.
So you just
don't get to go into the voting booth if you're in Florida, because right. that litigation is still ongoing in terms of trying to make it more people eligible for reinstatement.
And I don't want to minimize the argument of not being able to vote, but at the same time, you are just one vote, and you know, when you have whatever it is in Florida, 30 million people, one vote really doesn't matter. But I would posit that if you do raise your hand in front of the local politician and say, "Sir, ma'am," that probably carries more weight, at least, you know, with that individual legislator.
Absolutely.
And that is absolutely something that all 800 plus or minus 1,000 of us can go do in our local jurisdictions. And we would be able to move this ball way further than Twitter posts or making kooky videos or having a conference.
Absolutely. The number of people who participate in community events, when politicians show up, if they have more than 25 or 30, it's amazing. Oftentimes the get-togethers are far smaller, and you have that one-on-one time where you can actually talk about these issues. Now, they're going to still do political answers, because everybody has the capability of recording them and tweeting them,
right,
and live streaming them,
yeah,
and all this stuff. So they're going to be guarded if they don't know you. The only time you're going to get a freewheeling conversation is when they trust you and know you, that you're not streaming them and they can have a one-on-one with you and you're not going to use it against them. But you go to these events and you can get some very quality time. If it's a small group and there's 15 people there, And the person's going to be there for an hour. You can bring up an issue that's important to you and have a discussion. And
And
then perhaps arrange a time to have a more thorough discussion with just you and the person.
only when they do these town hall meetings and there's some super hot issue like the taking away the kids from the South Americans and Central Americans, only when you have a town hall meeting from that kind of situation do you end up with 500 people in there all screaming at them and they need security and all that stuff. But on a normal recess, whatever, when they're back in their districts, is it, that's when there would just be a normal number of people there.
Particularly at the state level, when you're talking about state senators and state representatives, which are primarily who makes the policies that affect registered population, the federal role is far less significant than people think about it. Your registry rules are made by your state and local governments. The federal stuff are just simply suggestions and minimum standards, and many states have exceeded those recommended minimum standards. And there again, you're fighting the wrong battle. Everybody wants to run to DC and fight about this. That'd be nice. Be nice if the AWA had not passed. But a lot of states are doing things that are not required by the AWA, and we could impact those decisions more at the local level. So we need to get more vocal in terms of what we'll accept from our state officials.
Yeah, I remember somewhere around 2010, the Republicans were getting their town halls overrun over certain issues, and then there, it does flip back and forth. I mean, there are hot issues on this side or that side that overrun those particular politicians in those districts.
Yes, I think it was probably the what was the Wall Street
That was the
the nine number
the 99 percenters.
well.
That was that. That's similar to the tax cuts of whatever 6 months ago. Well, all right. Are we done with that?
Sure.
I mean, that's to me, that's something that's very empowering to me. It's also kind of scary to go stand in front of these people. I realize they put their pants on the same way, but they are intimidating to me. They do kind of freak me out because they have a lot of power and, maybe eloquent speech, whatever. That's how I feel about people in those kind of positions. But it is something that we can do, and no, and I, you'd be hard pressed to have any sort of registry restrictions that would stop you from doing it. Right? I mean, I've heard you say that it's like, hey, look, if I were under these conditions, I'd be damned if they would stop me from going and doing X with my local person to voice my opinion.
I've made that about the Capitol. Some people say that their Capitol is off limits because it's within 1,000 or whatever feet. And I say the day will never come when I would refuse to go to my Capitol. The fundamental right you have is to petition for redress of your grievances. And if you can't go to the Capitol, I believe that even with a conservative court, you could win that battle, that the Capitol is open to everyone.
I
It's
think I
open to you.
seems like it would even be more protected by a conservative panel.
Well, let's hope so. I sometimes they have ways of twisting themselves into contorted pretzels to not be consistent, but I'm hoping that even they would find that. And the recent ruling in Packingham, they suggested that they would even, particularly people that have convictions, have the right to and the desire to be involved in the process.
Moving
This
on,
next
go ahead.
article is going to be a struggle for me because there was no opinion to read. It was just a news story,
Yeah,
and
I know.
I don't really want to comment on much because it's well, we can comment and say that I don't know, but I'm trying to find out, trying to get a copy of the opinion.
I mean, the title of the article is Judge Upends Sex Offender Registration. Person does a sexual offense kind of thing, and then the judge says he doesn't have to register. I mean, that's, and this is up in Pennsylvania, up in the Philadelphia area. And said that we're not going to destroy the guy's life for his misdeeds, and so we're just you're going to do your probation or your prison sentence, and then you don't have to register.
I think if we could either get a Pennsylvania lawyer or certainly get a copy of the opinion, neither have I been able to obtain of the two opinions that were referenced in the article, the one from Westmoreland, I believe it was, and then this one from Westchester.
He is currently serving an 18-month prison sentence in Chester County. So, my point is that it's a good news thing, regardless of whatever the opinion was. I mean, I realize that there's legal value in the other side of it, but to me, this is a good news thing that someone is seeing some light out of the whole thing.
Yes, yeah, so Montgomery County Judge William Carpenter overturned registration requirements also, and that was referenced in this article.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email. Registry Matter. Tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. This next article is from Times Union News. I guess it's just Times Union. And it is Albany, so that could be all kinds of different states. But let's go with New York for the moment. Yeah, it's Andrew Cuomo, so it's New York. Critics say pardons will give sex offenders access to schools. Gosh, that sounds like fire and brimstone right there. This is going to allow places for people with registry requirements. They're going to be allowed to go to schools to vote. I mean, why would you want them to be allowed to go to schools, Larry?
This is so absurd that it's hardly worth the dignity of the podcast. I mean, people have been using voting precincts have been established at schools all throughout the ages. All my life, I can remember polling places. I have never heard of all my decades of anybody doing anything in a highly confined, supervised environment like a school. Now, the schools are far more supervised today than they were back decades ago before we had low-cost surveillance that watched every time a person moves. And to think that something, when they set up a polling station, it's not that every classroom is a polling station. They usually set it up in a
like the gymnasium
area.
Yeah.
Or the gym.
Yep.
Or someplace. And the people go to that particular part of the property and cast their ballots where there's enormous amount of supervision. This is scaremongering, fear tactics of people who don't want those folks to vote. That it's a way to try to create an issue. It's a, what is it? A solution in search of a problem.
I'll go with that.
There's no problem.
So, I mean, generally on voting days, schools are closed. So I think that would mean you would have just shy of zero children there. I can't imagine that up on the stage, like behind the curtain, there's just going to be this battery of kids back there just waiting to be preyed upon by a bunch of sex offenders. So I don't think that's the issue. Come on. Somebody help me out with where they think this actually would come from that.
Well, I have voted many times when schools are actually open and functioning as a school.
Okay.
But like I say, it's the issue has jumped. I'm just reading from the article because I don't want people to bash me. I'm going to read from the article. The issue has jumped to the public's consciousness as a result of outcry by some Republicans about conditional pardons recently issued by Governor Andrew Cuomo that could speed up the restoration of voting rights for sex offenders on parole. So there again, we've got the Republican Party in New York creating a problem that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Registered sex offenders have voted, former felons, regardless of their offense, have voted in schools all across the land for ages without any problem. If any of the listeners out there knows where there's been some criminality, particularly of a sexual offense by someone, please let us know about that. But because it's like the Halloween boo scare.
Right.
No one can find any evidence that anything happens, but yet we're trying to search for a problem to get people excited about a solution that we don't need a solution. There's no problem to solve.
I know you don't watch many movies, but like you'll see in the superhero movie, so the super bad villain goes into a massive public place with all his masked gunmen, and they start laying down some fire and scares everybody to death, and now they're all corralled in. That's not really how it goes down. Where a sex offender goes out and says, ha ha, let's go to this public place. There will be 500 people looking at me, and I'm going to go in there and I'm going to snatch the next little kid, and I'm going to run out of there, and no one's going to do a thing. Really? So how is this a solution to any existing problem other than to just scare people?
Well, that and to try to suppress the vote, which I believe that may be part of the sinister ploy. If we whip up enough outcry, these people won't show up to vote. And this would be a good one for Lenore Scanese,
right,
one of our followers, because she could tell us that nothing's happened in a school on election day.
Yeah.
Other than the things that normally happen in schools on ordinary days.
If anything, you'd be safer because you've got so many more people.
Absolutely.
The election officials, the other adults who are voting, assuming that only a small fraction of the population that would be voting would be sexual offenders, it would seem like they'd be outnumbered by regular people. So if they start trolling and lurking and groping and fondling, that they would be under supervision and that someone would react in a non-positive way.
Yeah, we're talking about problems that are in search of, solutions that are in search of problems. So this is just this is a no-brainer. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
That's how people won elections recently. I said on the last podcast or podcast before the thing about the runaway border.
Yep.
The border is more secure than it's been in decades. But yet, one of the significant issues was about secure the southern border. Well, it's actually quite secure comparatively to the 90s when there was 3 and 4 and 5 times as many people coming across. I mean, they were coming in waves back then, and we had very low apprehension rates. A lot of people got through. Now, the getting through is just it's much less likely you'll ever successfully get through, although people still do get through.
Yeah,
but and the border is more secure than it's been in our lifetime.
And we talked about that, and I mentioned a podcast, and the guy's name is Malcolm Gladwell. He has a podcast called Revisionist History, and he goes back, and one of the original people in charge of border control stuff, it was a general of some kind, 50s or something like that, 40s time frame, 60s time frame. And because they locked down the border, now all the people that had gotten in, now they didn't leave. They would have gone home when the growing season or whatever that that timeline would be for them. They would have just gone home. Maybe they would have come back. You would have less permanent immigrants, illegal immigrants in the country had you let the border still be traversed relatively easy. They don't necessarily want to be here. They don't want their family to be on the other side of the border or in, you know, three countries down. They're here. They want to do a job. They want to get back home. I still don't personally see a problem with this idea, but so when they locked down the border, the people got trapped inside.
I believe that there's a core of American people, and I don't know the percentage, but they like being afraid of things that don't exist to be afraid of, like the tidal wave of crime. Crime has actually been on a perpetual free fall for 2.5 decades since the early 90s. But people were scared to death in the last election about the runaway crime epidemic. Now, there are pockets of crime problems in the country. And as we heard a lot out of Chicago last couple of years about the homicide rate in Chicago. But you could compare that to the New York homicide rate, which has been really reduced to levels hadn't been seen since the 1950s and 60s.
Right.
And other major cities with similar results. But I think Americans like to be afraid. And if they can't be mad and fearful, they're not happy. And I think that's what this articles that we just talked about, there's a segment of people out there that this appeals to.
Yeah.
There's an imaginary boogeyman, and it gives them the satisfaction they need to be angry about something.
Well, this probably fits right into it. From the Daily Business Review, appeals court weighs restoration of felons' rights. And this is related to Florida and their ability to get their rights to vote back in restored. And I'm pretty sure in the article they use the number 40. There are 40 states. Yes. Would I be correct to say that 40 states restore rights automatically for felons convicted of certain crimes? Gail said, asking how many of the states employ no standards for this important decision. We're not aware of any state that has clemency processes that are directed by neutral. Sorry, I've gotten off the point. There are approximately 40 states that automatically restore your rights to vote, at least at the end of your sentence, if not before. Like we said, up in the New England area, there are a couple states that have you're allowed to vote while you're still down, which is kind of neat. But wouldn't you like it that either immediately post prison or post your paper sentence that you get like, hey, I just show back up at the ballot box and drop my ticket in?
Well, according to this article, the state requires felons to wait 5 or 7 years to apply for restoration and years after that to complete the process. Since the process went into effect 2011, the Clemency Board has restored about 3,000 of the 30,000 who've applied, which is 10%. Compared to more than 155,000 whose rights were restored under former Governor Charlie Crist, and about 70,000 who gained their rights under Crist's predecessor, Jeb Bush, and both former governors were Republicans. when asked why purely discretionary clemency would not violate the Constitution, the whatever, I can't pronounce that name, said clemency does not take rights away. And I don't understand what he means by that.
I'm going to call it Guanipa. Is the that's who you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, you're Raida Guanipa, a Miami consultant.
Guanipa is a plaintiff. Yeah.
Wow.
Guanipa is among the plaintiffs in the lawsuit challenging the executive clemency. The board.
Well, they're in reading the article, they are talking about some. If you want to make a non-biased, hey, do people have blue eyes? Psh, they can vote. Brown eyes, can't vote. Is there a neutral way to set up an evaluation system of which people to reinstate their voting rights? And nobody appears to have any sort of standard other than, hey, you finished your sentence, your prison side, your paperwork side, or some other just timeline-oriented thing. Maybe you completed a class. You get your rights back, but Florida makes this really ambiguous process to let you get your voting rights back that it's just, hey, a shot in the dark.
Well, it's one of those things where it's at the courts, it's at the 11th Circuit, and Florida is arguing, of course, that the Attorney General, that's that name I couldn't pronounce, Amit Agarwal told the panel.
Amit Agarwal. Sorry. We're butchering names today.
Well, you guys in Florida can call in or write in and tell us how to. You probably need to call in and pronounce it for us. Because you've heard it many times where we don't hear Florida news very often.
But back to the enshrining of your right to vote. Where would the privilege, where would the permission to be taken away from voting be stated?
I don't know.
And we've talked about this before. You can make stronger protections of the Constitution, and we've talked about Maryland, where it's any sort of level of, it's not disability. What's the word I'm looking for? If you hamper somebody,
disadvantages.
Disadvantages. So you can't do anything that disadvantages someone. Whereas it seems like this would be a pretty significant disadvantage, so we could then surmise that the Florida Constitution doesn't have those words of making some sort of disadvantage. How would it be then that Florida says you never get your voting rights back? That would violate the federal Constitution.
Well, they do have a process, just that under this current administration, the process they have, it's very few people are getting it. You heard the number, 3,000.
Yeah.
Under this process versus tens of thousands under the processes. So they have, again, if you trace it back, since Florida's under conservative control right now, it would appear as though the conservatives got unhappy with how many people were being restored the right to vote under the previous process. That's what it would appear like looking from the outside, because two former governors who were both Republican restored a whole lot more people.
And unless you could point your finger at some sort of, hey, these people didn't meet a certain criteria or that, and obviously you have a huge disparity of numbers between the different administrations, this particular governor is just saying, FYP, you can't vote.
That's what it appears to be, and certainly people from Florida can contact us and help us understand this, and we'll take it up again on a future podcast. I think I'll put this in here.
Yeah, you did.
Because there again, it's to show that progress is being made and people are fighting to try to get your voting rights restored. But you need to be calling, whether you're a voter or not, you need to be calling your elected official in Florida and say, this is unacceptable.
All right. Well, here we go. We're going to talk about the big deal. I wanted, you've said something a couple of times, and I'm sort of not trying to spoil it. I want to make it a big reveal at the end, but I don't know how to get there. But you've used, we have all heard the term, quote unquote, frightening and high recidivism rate, and that it was authored by the Supreme Court, and the soon-to-be-retired Justice Kennedy is the one that penned that decision. And we all run around saying that Justice Kennedy did it. And you've thrown, like, nope, that's not how it happened. And
I do that every chance I get. So this podcast, I'm going to tell all of our listeners again that.
So this is where we were wrong. We're listening to the wrong information.
In my opinion, of course, opinion, you know what they say about opinions.
There are a certain number of those that exist.
Yes, but we will wanted to talk about the case in the Tenth Circuit Court before we get to the main topic, and that's that the National Association for Rational Sexual Defense Laws, NARSL, just filed an amicus brief in the Tenth Circuit.
Tell me about that.
In support of the three plaintiffs who successfully challenged Colorado's registry as being punitive. And thus, they won a decision at the trial court level with what's called a senior U.S. district judge, meaning it generally means an aged person, but that's not how you get to be senior status. Well, it is, actually. You have to reach a certain age, and then you can either retire or you can take senior status, and that opens up a brand new judgeship because senior judges don't have to take a full caseload. So they create a brand new opening for another judgeship. But senior judge Richard Mage, after hearing from the plaintiffs without experts, decided that based on their experience, that he found that the registry caused occupational and housing disadvantages. And then a third plaintiff named Vega, he found that the deregistration process was so arbitrary and capricious that it was unconstitutional because it was up to a judge to set moving targets. And you didn't know how to meet it, even though you proved that you had not offended for years and years and years. You couldn't meet the standard. NARSL put the brief in as a friend of the court, amicus, in support of the decision asking the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals to uphold or affirm and ratify what the trial judge found. Every attorney general from the states that make up the 10th Circuit put in an amicus brief saying Judge Mage got it all wrong. It needs to be overturned. And then there were 17 professors and legal experts who authored another amicus brief on behalf of the plaintiffs, and they focused on recidivism. NARSL focused a little bit on recidivism, but we focused a little bit more on the impact on family, the collateral consequences to family. Like one of the plaintiffs is shut out of his school, participating in school with his raising his children. He's a full-time father. And we focused on the loss of jobs and the fact that the Colorado statute doesn't provide any protection against misuse of information. And we went at it from a slightly different angle, that the legislature, when they drafted it, they recognized the potential for abuse. And they said that it's not our intent that happen, but they didn't put anything in place to prevent it from happening. So we pointed out to the court that even the legislature recognized that this public dissemination could result in bad things happening, but then they didn't do anything to stop bad things from happening. And bad things have happened to these individuals as a result of the public dissemination.
Well, so, answer me this question. Does a court, when receiving these amicus briefs, do they weigh one more heavily than another one? Meaning, like, the law professors that write it, does that counter the attorney generals? Attorneys general?
Well, that's the intent of it. It's hard to say, not having been inside it. You need to ask a person who's been a clerk that's had close relationships with appellate level judges. I have talked to people who think amicus briefs are not worth anything, and people who swear by them that they make all the difference in the world. I'm not as convinced that one's going to be as significant in this decision, because that wasn't what Judge Mage hung his hat on for finding of unconstitutionality. He didn't look at recidivism very much, so I don't think it's going to be as relevant. But it's there for those who love to hear that argument made. It's there in that brief that was put in. And the NARSLs, like I say, we focused slightly differently. But I think that the briefs are important. That's why we did it. We
Certainly.
Wanted to try to uphold the decision.
And there, I mean, I guess there's something to be said about the credibility of the organization or the individuals writing. I mean, if you're a first-term law professor, I would suspect that you have less influence than a 30-year, 40-year tenured professor, you know, like Catherine Carpenter, who's been around for a long time. I'm sure that her opinion would carry more relevancy than the new guy on the block. So then NARSL, being an organization that's been around for like almost 10 years, et cetera, seems like it would carry more weight. Can you even like speculate what the DAs would say, other than these people are dangerous, high, frightening,
well,
and high,
exactly
and all that?
That's what they did say. That's what the attorneys general did say in their brief, that recidivism was frightening high, that this was merely civil, non-punitive, and that any inconveniences were de minimis. I mean, that's what they argued.
But forget the recidivism rate you guys focused on the other issues of employment problems and housing problems, aren't those, I mean, you could easily demonstrate those to be fact and not just an opinion. It's funny that we're going to be talking about that opinion here in a minute, but you could show that information along with the recidivism rate and all the other things like the registry doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. You can demonstrably demonstrate that those things are true.
Well, that's correct. We did focus on recidivism, but it was not of the same level. We did point out that there was disagreement among experts about recidivism, but as I've said so many times, in Smith versus Doe, they did not decide that it was okay to have the registry because of recidivism. They decided after they did the analysis of the 7 Kennedy-Mendoza factors that they could not see punishment in that scheme. They looked beyond the debate about recidivism. People focus too much, in my opinion, on that. But we did mention it, but it wasn't the high point of our brief.
Interesting.
We tried to track the decision because we're trying to give the appellate panel, there'll be a 3-judge panel that'll decide this. We're trying to give the panel additional information to bolster what Judge Bache had found. As a friend of the court, we can get things in that weren't necessarily in the trial record. So that was our strategy, was to give additional information that would not have necessarily come out during the trial.
Well, let me throw this in there too. I happened to be on my Roku and I noticed that all the Narsal, the conference videos just got released, and hey, the quality of them came out really good. I'm quite proud of them. But I was listening to, I was watching Paul Dubling, and he said that with all of that stuff, when you bring it to a judge, with all of that evidence to back up what we are saying, it provides them with a certain degree of cover that they can make those, that they can make that decision that is in our favor with a whole lot of walls and barriers up. It's not like they're just saying, well, it feels wrong, so I ruled in the plaintiff's favor. They are given recidivism studies. They are given the detriment to their employment status or their housing status. They have cover to inform their decision if something goes wrong where one of these people coming off the registry offends and they're like, oh my God, you voted to let this person off, right?
I can see his logic behind that. It does make sense that if the court's inclined to grant relief on constitutional claims, that debunking that would be worthwhile. I don't have any objection to people making the argument. I just don't think it alone is going to win the day. But I have no objection to the argument being made.
And other part that I want to bring up, it's not quite directly related. You don't have a constitutional right to housing. You don't have a constitutional right to a job. There are just all these things that you don't have a constitutional right. You certainly have a humanity kind of right to these things, but there's no protection for you to have these things from our constitution,
well, interstate that is travel. Correct.
So
you do have a right to interstate travel, absolutely. But in terms of jobs, no, you don't have a right to a job. But you don't. The government shouldn't be suppressing your ability to compete. That's what they're doing with the registry. They're putting you in a position where you can't compete. They're tying all your hands and everything behind your back.
Yeah. I guess it was interstate travel then. You have a right to travel inside your state. You don't have a right to travel to another state.
Well, there's debate about whether you have enshrined in the Constitution a right to travel outside the country. I think you have the right to an opportunity to travel without being impeded. Right. But I don't think you have the right. I don't think you have the right to be admitted.
If that would be the case.
Then we should admit anybody who shows up at our door.
I totally get that you may be able to get there, but you might not be allowed in. I totally get that. Like, they could refuse anybody they want if they want to. I get that concept.
Absolutely.
But I can't imagine why our government would care whether you left or not. I can't
Well,
even...
it would seem to be good riddance.
It would be.
You would want them.
But yeah, if
they're that bad, you would hope and pray that they do leave.
They sure went and got that guy from Kansas, from the Philippines. They sure went and that went to the Supreme Court. And Sotomayor was like, you guys went and got him and brought him back? What is wrong with you? Like, he was gone. Wouldn't you want these deplorables, you know, whatever term you want to use, lowlifes, violent people, wouldn't you want them to go somewhere else? But anyway, we've taken about 3 wrong turns now in getting here. You ready to go on?
So let's do it.
All right. We all know about the Smith versus Doe out of Alaska, right? Is that that's where everyone thinks this comes from?
Most of our listeners have heard of Smith Force Sisto.
Can you give me like a one paragraph synopsis of Smith Vito? Is that too much to ask?
It was a challenge based on ex post facto clause of a person who did not want to, didn't feel like that he should have to register because it was an obligation that didn't exist. And he said that you just can't make ex post facto laws. And the courts in Alaska agreed with him that you couldn't do that. And the state of Alaska filed what's called a cert petition with the United States Supreme Court, said, we need to get this poor decision overturned. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, actually, you can have ex post facto laws. You just cannot have, you can't increase someone's punishment, but you can change a regulatory scheme or other laws, just not criminal laws. You need to know the penalties that you're going to have extracted, and something needs to be unlawful at the time you do it. And you can't elevate something to an unlawful status after the fact or elevate the penalty. But then they looked at the regulatory scheme that was in place in Alaska, and they said that we don't see using an old established. Now, they made this decision in 2003, and they looked at the precedent, which we talk about precedent in the judicial setting. They used the presidential decision from 1963, which was 40 years prior, and that was Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez, where they had determined how you would examine and dissect a regulatory scheme and determine if it inflicted punishment. And they looked at those seven factors, and they said, we don't see that this requirement to register in and of itself inflicts punishment. Mailing in a form and putting your name on a list is not punitive. It's similar to what you would have to do in a regulatory scheme, similar to your driver's license or your vehicle registration. And therefore, it is constitutional. It is not punishment. That's what they said in 2003. They didn't say, like people said, it was a green light to do everything you wanted to do. They said, we're finding it constitutional because it doesn't impose any disability restraints. It doesn't impair a person in terms of where they can work. There's no occupational debarments. They can work wherever they want to. They can travel wherever they want to. They can live wherever they want to.
The information's not publicly posted, right?
I think it might have been publicly posted at that time, but certainly that same term in 2003, they had another case. They decided Connecticut Department of Public Safety versus Doe, where they said that information could be publicly posted about the registry, the registration status. But the challenge in Alaska was just simply, could they subject a person to a regulatory requirement to register? And the Supreme Court said in a 6-3 decision that yes, you can, because it doesn't inflict punishment. Everybody extrapolates that to say that they said that no matter what you do to a person on a registry requirement, that it will never be construed as punishment. Therefore, it's Katie, bar the door, do whatever you want. They didn't say that.
So then you move over to a state like Rhode Island, where they had living restrictions, and they're increasing it for 300 to 1,000 feet. How is that not punishment?
Well, you could argue. Now, I try to be able to argue both sides of an issue.
I think that's legit. That's fair.
And if I were the Attorney General of Rhode Island, I would argue that since we don't have a blanket policy, it doesn't apply to all sexual offenders. It only applies to the level threes, which have gone through a risk assessment. This is not a level three based upon their crime of commission. This is an individualized risk assessment. I would say that we are able to have a regulatory scheme that does, in fact, keep the community safer, because we feel like that people who have high risk of offending and have had child victims per se, if that's a part of the risk assessment process, if that helps you get to level three, I don't know the innards of the process, but I know they do have. I would argue that since it's narrowly tailored, that we can do this and we can do it retroactively. On the other side, if I were the ACLU, which is fighting that, I would say, well, you can do that, but then you've got the takings clause to deal with, because you're taking away their contractual agreement that they may have made with an apartment complex, the ownership of their home. Yes, they can still own it, but they no longer live in it. So therefore, you've done an economic harm to them. So I would argue the takings clause, and I think that legal minds can disagree. We're hopeful, NARSL is, that they will agree with our position. That's why we raised money and we've put $15,000 into that challenge to help fund the experts to testify. And we're hoping that when it someday does go to trial, which it's bogged down now because the legislature amended the law to make it even worse, in my opinion, which they do from time to time. They the part of the complaint of the lawsuits pending is the ambiguity of defining what constitutes a school and how to do
yes.
the measurements.
Right.
So they defined how to do the measurements and what qualifies as a school, and it's even worse than before. So that's going to extend the discovery process. But yes, I would say that there's some very serious constitutional questions there, and that's why we're in that case, because we think that it might be punitive to force a person out of their home. There's no bite. It is punitive to force a person out of their home.
Seems I can't imagine any other way to look at that. If the if the popo is going to come up and knock on your door and say get out, and you say no, I live here, I own this, and then they come in with a tank and they force you to move, that sounds punitive to me.
It certainly does to me.
All right. Well, that's Smith v. Doe, and that's out of Alaska, and that's 03. But there's something that happened prior to that that is at least a part of the nexus of where Smith v. Doe comes from, because we all talk about this frightening and high. There's something that happens prior to that about 10 years earlier.
It wasn't that year. It was 2002, wasn't it?
I thought it was 93. I could be wrong.
No, the McCune versus Lyle was decided June 10, 2002. It was 1 year preceding.
Shows what I know about dates. All right, so a year-ish before,
yes.
We have McCune v. Lyle, which is an inmate who is suing the warden of a prison in Kansas for a Fifth Amendment protection of incriminating himself. He did a bad thing. He had sex with a minor. He says it was consensual. She says it wasn't. And I don't particularly care about the issue there, but he's been down for about 6 years or so, and he had worked his way up to having a certain level of privileges at a prison. And he goes to an institution where he has a little bit cushier of a life. They have TVs in the rooms, and they have some weights, and you know, so forth. Maybe it's a safer place, just more loose kind of prison. And they say, hey, you're going to take part in the sex abuse treatment program. But part of that requires you to make an admission of responsibility, saying, yes, I know I committed a crime. I did it. I'm guilty. And he says, no, Fifth Amendment, I don't have to do that because I didn't do what you all said I did, that I was convicted of. They move him, since he refuses to do all this, they move him to a more strict facility, a high security place. They upped his level from level 1 to level 3, whatever that means, in Kansas in 2002. And he loses all these privileges. And he's like, wait a minute, that's moving the goalpost. I have a Fifth Amendment protection. I don't have to sign that statement of the admission of responsibility. This goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I'm going to let you take it from there because I am, that goes beyond my pay grade.
Well, I'll be happy to do my best. I haven't read this case in years, and it's a very lengthy read. So I didn't even read the dissenting. We'll talk about the dissenting judges later. But what I read was the majority, which was 5-4. Four agreed, and then one judge agreed with the outcome for slightly different reasons. But what you have here is a typical situation where facts are determined below, and when I say below, I mean the courts below, and they're handed to the Supreme Court. And this case was brought as a 42 United States Code 1983, which is a civil rights violation. It was brought in the federal district court, and the trial judge agreed with the complaint of the individual named Lyle. He found, I believe it was a he, but let's just use, if I'm wrong, but the trial judge, but whether it be he or she found that was the way you described it and set it up. They told the guy he was within a zone of being released from his incarceration. And they said, before you're released, you're going to have to take this treatment program. And he said, I'll take the program. And then when they handed him the disclosure he had to make, he found himself in an interesting position, because he had testified at trial that he didn't do the rape, and it was consensual. And at the point that he wrote his confession, he would have had to have wrote that he did do, and he felt he would be potentially going to be prosecuted for perjury because his story was no longer the same. And it's probably unlikely that he would have been prosecuted for perjury, but it's a possibility, because if the prosecutor didn't like the fact he was getting out, and all of a sudden they had evidence he committed perjury, if I'm a prosecutor and I need to keep somebody in the jail or in prison to keep the community safe, I'm going to say, well, thanks for the gift.
They said they'd never convicted anybody of, they've never prosecuted anybody for it before. That doesn't mean they wouldn't do it again.
Well, no, they said they for sexual disclosures. They didn't say for perjury.
Okay.
Perjury.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
For the unprosecuted sexual disclosures, but he had testified that he didn't do the rape.
Right.
And okay, so imagine you're a prosecutor. Try to put yourself in a prosecutor who's got angry constituents out there on a high profile case, and the person's getting out of prison, and the prosecutor gets handed a confession saying I committed perjury at trial, because in order for him to be in the sex offender treatment program, he had to admit that he committed the crime. And so at that point, you have two different stories. He could not have not done it as he testified at trial, and he could not turn around and say, I did it to be successful in treatment. So he would have had to have perjured himself. And therefore, he said, I don't have to do that. I don't have to perjure myself. I don't have to incriminate myself. And the five in the majority, they were handed the fact, because at the lower court, it was determined in a summary judgment. And you want to know what a summary judgment is, right?
Yes, I absolutely would want to know the definition of a summary judgment.
Well, cases can be decided by having a full-blown trial, or they can be decided on the pleadings, and that's called summary judgment. And on a summary judgment, one or both parties can ask for a summary judgment. They can say, look, we've done the pleadings, we've put in our complaint, we've put in our response, and then we've put in our reply, and we've done discovery. We've done everything we want to do. We've looked at everything. And judge, there's no need for a trial here. This is clear cut. So one or both parties move for summary judgment. And in a summary judgment, the court makes a decision based on the pleadings. And if there's anything in the pleadings that are even possibly not true, the court has to construe them as true. So Kansas would have said in their pleadings that the reason why we do this is because we've learned that sex offenders are dangerous, and they recidivate at a very high rate. That would have been in the pleadings at the trial court, and the trial court went ahead and granted summary judgment and said, you can't do that. You cannot force this man to do this. The trial judge said that. But that was the factual determination that the parties agreed to, that we're doing this program, recidivism is off the charts, this is the reason why we do it. And The attorney for Lyle said, well, it's nice that the recidivism is high, but I've got an absolute right not to incriminate myself. And the trial judge agreed.
Right.
And then Kansas appealed to the appellate court in Denver, the 10th Circuit, and the Court of Appeals agreed.
Okay.
They upheld the trial judge. So there again, the facts were reaffirmed in the appellate process. The Supreme Court was handed a fact in the case that Kansas said we do this because of frightening high recidivism. The Supreme Court doesn't conduct trials.
Right.
They don't determine the facts. The facts were handed to them. They interpreted the Constitution. So they interpreted the Constitution that said, well, now legal minds can disagree. And this breaks out beautifully along ideological lines. So in terms of conservative versus liberal judges, the conservative judges said, well, you're a prisoner, and you have very few rights. Society gets to intrude upon you in ways that would not normally be tolerable. And this isn't truly, you're not being compelled to do this because nothing's bad happening to you. You're not getting any additional time added to your sentence. You're just getting a less cushy prison assignment. They're making way for people who want to be in this treatment program, this facility. So therefore, since you don't want to be there, you don't want to partake of this wonderful rehabilitative opportunity, you can step aside, and they've moved you aside, and they've moved another person in the slot, and we don't see a problem with that. They, for liberal judges at the time, said, well, whoa, this, I mean, if you're going to take away privileges and diminish a person's expectations that they've worked their way up to, this certainly seems like a compulsion to us.
To me, it feels like moving the goalpost.
Well, it does, but you can see how they would get to their decision, because your rights are so diminished in prison, and they weren't increasing his amount of time. He didn't forfeit any good time.
Yeah.
He merely didn't get to serve his time in as cushy of a situation as he would have. But on the other hand, had he incriminated himself, he might would have gotten a whole bunch more time because the prosecutor Certainly. Could have filed perjury charges.
Yes.
So he was in a tough dilemma.
I totally get it.
but the Supreme Court did not determine that the recidivism was frightening and high. That was determined in the pleadings below that the parties consented to when they said we want summary judgment.
And just I just want to clarify this and make sure I understand it. Back way back at the original trial, the original with the original pieces of evidence. So the state side, they present the evidence of frightening and high or whatever. Could the plaintiff side said, no, that's not correct, and at least had that entered into evidence as being a counter opinion?
Had they wanted a trial, they could have.
And probably would have needed to had they wanted a trial.
But they didn't want a trial. They wanted summary judgment because they said we win. Kind of like the same thing that happened in Alaska year later. The guy says, don't tell me your problems. You want to have a retroactive law. You just can't have a retroactive law. It's unconstitutional. And the ex post facto clause kills you. So therefore, we don't want to. Well, they did the same thing here. They were saying, well, the Fifth Amendment is absolute. You don't have to incriminate yourself.
We don't care about that particular piece of evidence because we're just fighting for this one little piece of it without looking at, you know, zooming out 30,000 feet, however you want to word that, looking at a much broader thing. How is this going to screw somebody at a later date because we don't care about this right now?
Well, that was the attorney that was representing Lyle was trying to get his guy back in the cushy prison.
From a more woke point of view, where you could say, oh, hey, 10 years from now, these cases are going to come down the pike and they're going to use this evidence against all these other people. I know we don't care about them right now, but I mean, they're not, I don't care about them because I'm representing you, but here's something that's going to screw a whole lot of people down the road.
You wouldn't have known that at the time. All you would have known at the time was that you were trying to win your case for your obligation under the rules of professional conduct ethics or to win the case for your client.
But I'm saying someone such as yourself that is able to look four or five chess moves out, you would go, oh, wait a minute, there's a problem here.
I might would have now, but we have to look at we have the luxury of looking back at how the case law has unfolded. At the time, I might would have been just as arrogant, thinking, well, gee, they can't do this. This is a no-brainer. This is it's clearly the Fifth Amendment. They don't have to give testimony against – we're asking this man to give testimony against himself, and he's risking prosecution if he does that.
Yes.
I would have probably thought that was a no-brainer at the time.
Right. But then, you know, that – particular, you know, almost like a narrow scope kind of thing. Here's what we're looking at, this one little thing and Fifth Amendment, and that's it. This evidence gets introduced by the state side, and now that gets enshrined, like, you know, this is the hurdle that we're fighting, that everyone says that the recidivism rate is frightening and high, which I know isn't a constitutional question, but that is what has been cited hundreds of times since then as being
absolutely
the reason why we are so interested in putting the screws in these people is because it doesn't matter. They're untreatable. The recidivism rate is frightening and high.
Well, the lesson that I have learned from this is to be careful what facts you stipulate.
Fair.
Because on appeal, when a case is on appeal, the appeals court is looking at the facts that have been agreed to below, either established by a trial or in the case like in the Tenth Circuit case. Judge Mache is going to get a fair amount of deference for the decisions he made as a sitting trial judge because he heard the evidence and he was in the best position to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses and of the evidence. Well, in this case of McCune versus Lyle, there was no trial. There was merely pleadings. And when there's only pleadings, everything in the pleading is assumed true. So if Kansas said, we want this program because we're trying to treat a very problematic population and they're dangerous to the community, and we're doing the best we can to make the community safe by this program, the court was handed that by agreement of the parties. The court didn't find that. They weren't forced to find that because nobody wanted a trial. And, of course, if you're operating on a shoestring budget, a person who's sitting in prison, you're not wanting to be a big trial, wanting a big trial expense. You're wanting to win your case. And if you've got a judge that seems predisposed to granting you the relief you're asking for, who would not take a summary judgment in their favor? I think I would, too.
And he won his way up, you know, until the Supreme Court overruled it.
Until the Supreme Court overruled it on a 5-4 vote with the
with the conservatives being in the five and the more liberal judges being in the four.
Well, but I mean, there was one, there's the O'Connor is known as the flip-flop vote.
Yeah, and she decided to go with the conservatives on this, and she did it for slightly different reasons, but she gave them the fifth vote.
So how would they had the, how would you say it breaks down, though? I mean, the conservatives, obviously, they voted for, and then the liberals voted for, and O'Connor being the swing, going with the conservatives.
How would I what?
How would you break that down? I mean, well, is there more to read into that than just, 5-4?
The thing to read into it is that on most issues, when we're dealing with things that affect us, when I say us, I'm talking about people who have been in the criminal justice system, whether it be for your prison reform that you're in favor of, if you want to try to expand rights to prisoners and what constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, what's permissible in terms of interception of correspondence in prisons, censorship, whether it be due process, whether it be the confrontation clause, whether it be any number of things, search and seizure, you're more than likely going to get a decision out of the liberal wing of the court that's more in line with what we're looking for, which makes it frustrating for me when I see most of our people pound their chest about how they want conservatives appointed to the court, because right. The conservatives rarely align with us. So as you vote for the conservative who's going to appoint people to the Supreme Court, you're rarely going to get a decision. I'm looking for a tool out there that analyzes of the 80 or 90 decisions that go through the court. Not all of them are criminal related. A lot of them are things that are not related to criminal law. That right. It might be antitrust. It might be, like in the last case, you had the Janus decision regarding the union fair share dues.
ACA, and then you had the same sex marriage, and you have environmental regulation. You have all kinds of stuff that's not criminal.
Well, I find myself on all those other issues also being in alignment with the liberal wing of the court. I don't like those decisions, but a lot of our listeners are going to be for weakening the labor unions. For another example, of the 80 or 90 decisions, I would like to see a tool that shows the pictures of which justice was on which side of the issue. And it might help our people to understand that most of the time when it comes to an issue important to us, that the conservatives are more than likely going to be on the wrong side. Not 100% of the time. Justice Scalia was on the right side of confrontation. He believed strongly that that clause in the Constitution meant what it said. But he was not in our corner on many other issues in criminal justice. He was on the wrong side of many things. But on confrontation, he was as good as they came. But I'd like to be – you're never going to agree with anybody. The liberal wing of the court, you're never going to agree with them. I'm going to find decisions that I don't like out of them. But I'm going to agree with them more often.
I understand.
So that's what I go. I go for the averages, and I'm going to be in alignment with their views more often.
I'm trying to think of like the key takeaway points here, and what I'm very much trying to focus on. Since you dropped this bomb on me, it was maybe twice over roughly the last month where you brought this up, and I'd never heard of it. I always think of it as Smith v. Doe, but that the summary judgments is where it came from. So the state level of Kansas introduced this thing that got passed up to the Tenth Circuit,
yes.
And then they put their stamp on it and just passed it along, and it gets to the Supreme Court, which then I'm saying that the state level of Kansas introduced this thing, and now it's attributed to Kennedy as being the statement made in Smith v. Doe. We're talking like, I think 5 or 6 degrees removed from him actually saying it.
Well, he said it because he passed a majority opinion.
But he could have just copied it from the facts handed to him.
Yes, that is correct. He didn't invent this. Now the Supreme Court has enormous powers.
Of course,
they can look at a case and say this case is not ripe. We need to send it back. And if during the process of the briefings, if someone had argued that that frightening recidivism was not true, they could have said we're not ready to review this case yet. But if the parties are in agreement that this is ripe and they're ready to go forward with the facts that have been determined below, the Supreme Court does not determine facts; they determine the law.
And they interpret the law that is there, and I'm very fond of what Gorsuch said, and I think it's from you that said it, or like clued me into it, that the legislators, if they want something to be unambiguous. They have the vocabulary to write it as being unambiguous. And he's not going to interpret what they sort of intended to mean. If they wanted it there, they would have written it. I'm not going to read into it. I really like that a lot because, I mean, the laws should be specific and not be like, this kind of sort of is this way, sort of kind of red. Well, what kind of red? Do you mean maroon? No, I just red in general. Well, that could sort of mean orange. You know, there's just a whole lot of interpretation in there. And he's not, from that one thing, he's not interested in interpreting what they meant. Tell me what you want, and we can go from there.
That was the doctrine of Scalia, that he was a textualist. And he did not subscribe to what he referred to the purposivism. He said that was a word he invented. I'm not sure it's in the vocabulary, but he said, I'm not here to establish what the purpose is of something. I'm here to look at the text of what's written. And he gave the example, which I quote frequently, although it's not mine, it's his, about attorney's fees. He used the example of, if a statute says the prevailing party shall be awarded attorney's fees. And he says, well, in my vocabulary, attorney's fees means the fee for the attorney.
Yeah.
It does not include the experts, does not include the case-related costs. He said that gets into purposivism, which you're looking at that from somebody else's point of view that says, well, clearly, but the intent of that was to make the party that prevailed whole and to make them back to their position where they were. And he says, well, then they should have put that in the statute. They should have said, they could quite capable of saying that that the award of prevailing party will get attorney's fees, out-of-pocket cost, and blah, blah, blah. He said, they're capable of doing that. They didn't say that. So when I look at the text, it says attorney's fees. Therefore, I interpret that they get their attorney's fees. and people take issue with that. Well, I mean, that's a bona fide position if you're a textualist.
Yeah, sure.
But there are a lot of people who believe in purposivism, that you're supposed to look at the law's purpose. And he said, nope, we look at the text.
Right. Or what is their intent, or how does it change over time to reflect our evolving standards?
And he thought that was liberal mumbo jumbo.
Clearly.
That when we look at what these words would have meant at the time that they were written in terms of the Constitution, and we look at what the text of the statute is, and if you can't get there and what the statute says, then it fails. We're not supposed to save it and reword it for you. We're supposed to tell you that you didn't do it right, go back and redo it.
Which leads me back to, as we circle back around, if you want the registry to reflect what you want the registry to reflect, then you have to tell your politician. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it does matter how you vote, but you have to tell them what you want so they can at least introduce the change. And our people, generally, we're keeping our heads below the gunfire, and we are not stepping up and trying to make those changes. And that's not just the registry, but that's the people roasting in prisons. That's the length of sentences. And I have a really great quote, if you have your glasses back on, and I would like you to read it because it's going to sort of go against the grain because of who wrote it. And I would like to close out the podcast with this.
This quote, it says, I think solitary confinement is wrong, and our sentences in this country are 8 times longer than sentences for comparative crimes in Europe.
And who said that?
Anthony Kennedy.
Yep. So there you go. You've got somebody that's pretty, you know, far right on the conservative spectrum. And he has said that our sentences are too long and solitary confinement is pretty, pretty bad.
And he's also letting you know that if you don't like that, then you need, as a voter, to tell the people who are making these laws to stop doing it, because it's not my job, he's saying, wearing this black robe,
yep,
to tell you what the length of sentences should be. That's your determination.
Yep.
And if you're comfortable with paying the cost of sending people away for 8 to 10 times as long as other countries do, if you're okay with that, then don't expect me to save you from that, because that's not my job.
Yep. He's just there to reaffirm or interpret what the legislature has done. And we elect the legislature. I can't get this out enough times. It's just being buried in my head here that we are the ones that are in charge of these things. It's not some kangaroo court. It's not some shadow government. We actually can make these changes.
I love it. That's what I say and can't say enough, is that our laws will change when we, the people, demand that they change. We will stop sending people to be roasted away in prison We'll put air conditioning when people say that's what we want. We'll stop sending the people to prison for 144 months for looking at naked images when we demand that, that's an excessive punishment. But until they hear from us, those, as far as they're concerned, that is a reflection of what we want, because that's what everybody was clamoring for when these laws were passed, is we need to be tough on criminals. Well, we're tough.
We are certainly that. Not necessarily smart, but we're tough.
The United States is a very tough nation. Even in the most liberal states, we're still tough compared to international standards. And I'm saying international, I'm talking about the Western civilized world. I'm not comparing us to Somalia or Iran or some places that you wouldn't want to live. I'm comparing us to Sweden, to England,
just pretty much all of Europe or Canada.
Yes, I'm comparing us to Western style democracies. I'm not comparing us to the third world.
Yep. Larry, every time we talk, I always feel so much more inspired that we're going to make changes.
We are indeed, Andy. It's just you and I won't be alive.
That could be true. Well, I would appreciate it if all of you listeners, and we have an international audience, I want to make that clear. There is a listener, at least one, in the UK, and I would, you know, Nikki, hey, share the podcast with those you know so we continue to grow and grow our audience. The support on Patreon is always appreciated. It's the best way that you can support the show. Download numbers, tell us that you're interested. Leave comments and feedback. I try to respond to everything, and you can reach us at registrymatters.co. Sign up for an email notification if you want to receive something when the podcast goes out that a new episode is released, or like I said earlier, subscribe with a podcast app. If you want to leave voicemail, 747-227-4477. Email us directly, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And to reach us at Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters. One of the perks there, if you do subscribe even at the $1 a month level, is you'll get the podcast as soon as I'm done producing it, which usually happens Sunday afternoon. So you get it 36 or so hours early. And that's all I got.
Well, thanks, Andy. It's always great being with you.
Appreciate it, Larry. Have a great night. I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.